Welcome, everyone, to Film Strips, the podcast about films, about psychics who are useless. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Canning, sir.
Yeah, that wasn't the best joke I ever had, so I apologize for sort of, you know, giving you that moment's pause of what did he just say?
Oh, it's just, it's bad acoustics. Don't worry. Once, we'll fix it in post.
Absolutely. But yes, folks, welcome back to Film Strips, the podcast in which we talk about movies, but each film has to connect back to the episode previous to it. So, yes, Andrew, where were we?
The long, strange trip through global cinema. So this week we're here to actually get off the beaten path and by doing so find ourselves on the opposite side of the globe. This week we have gone from League of Extraordinary Gentlemen to Dario Argento's fondly remembered 1975 giallo horror film Deep Red.
Yes, the classic, or, well, let's say, I'm gonna put an asterisk beside that, but for amongst genre fans, a classic of the giallo genre from director Dario Argento. It's gonna be a tongue twister of an episode, folks.
Already off to a flying start. Connection fuzz, dropped punchline, and having to speak cursory Italian. This is why we generally stick to North America, but hey, We don't train so we can learn our limits. We train so we can go beyond them.
Yes, absolutely. So, yeah, so we've come from the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, as you said, via the route of David Hemmings, whose all-too-brief performance as Nigel in that film has led us to his starring role in this film. And, Andrew, this was your choice this week, and I mean, obviously, you could have chosen something to get revenge on me with, and you chose not to go that road. So I guess the question is, what led you to want to discuss this movie?
Well, I think I may have my revenge, just in a slightly different form. I wanted to look at this, largely because ever since Angel Heart, sort of horror hybrids have been on my mind. And Argento is a filmmaker that, well, I mean, I think he's an interesting one to talk about in the context of this show. It also gave us the opportunity to go beyond American film from 1975 to the present. Diversity is always good. And I also remember seeing this film back in my undergraduate days, and it leaving a pretty strong impression on me and wanting to go back and see, well, is it as good as I remembered it being? So I guess in order to introduce that, I mean, you're probably asking yourself, well, who's Dario Argento and why does he matter? He matters insofar as, well, if you're anything like me and David, growing up reading Fangoria magazine and all sorts of Web 1.0 blogs of the best horror films ever made, Argento is a name that pops up on those lists pretty often. And he has had a pretty interesting career in that there's basically two periods. He gets his start, I think his directorial debut is 68. Is that when The Bird with the Crystal Plumage comes out?
I want to say that that's 71, but maybe I'm misremembering the date on that one. I'll double check it while we, thanks to the wonders of the internet, you can now hear a search while we're recording this.
I know, and if it wasn't for another term beginning today, I probably would have had my research notes. So Argento, though, he gets his start writing and directing in the genre of the giallo film, and that is, it comes from a post-war Italian context. There's an emphasis on sort of true crime stories or ripped from the headlines. Also some lurid sensationalism, because hey, why not? It's my understanding, like I'm not deeply versed in giallo films, but generally it kind of forms a prototype of what the American slasher film would later be. And it's basically a hyper-stylized story. There's often a lot of play using the killer's own POV, things of that nature. And you can definitely see a lot of those influences, however cursory I understand them, at play in Deep Red. But I think more people are probably familiar with Argento for the films he does after this point in time, where he basically doubles down on this weird, quasi-surrealist, supernatural horror filmmaking. He is best known for, what is it, the Witches trilogy, which consists of Suspiria, Inferno, and then 20 years removed from them, The Mother of Tears.
Yeah.
And he's also well known as part of his legacy for fathering actress Asia Argento, who is pretty accomplished in her own right.
Yes, absolutely. And, well, we'll get to her one day, because I think there she's definitely, particularly over the last couple of years, as more information's come out about her dealings with Hollywood, has become even a far more fascinating figure than I would have initially expected.
Well, yeah, because so, I realized going into this, if we said the name Argento, more people would probably be thinking of Asia and the role that she's playing with Time's Up and the Me Too movements, and basically trying to hold people accountable and fix some systemic problems in Hollywood, which is even more interesting when we look at the gender subtext of this film. But, I mean, one doesn't necessarily inform the other, but it forms an interesting point-counterpoint.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But we'll get into that in a bit, a little bit further on in a moment. And I gotta say, Andrew, so you said you encountered Argento first in your undergraduate. And I guess what was your initial response to him? Just to sort of give us some grounding and context there.
The first film of his that I saw was Suspiria. And, because at the time, like Generation X and Waterloo, I think it had its own, section on the horror shelf. I thought it was very interesting because, you know, it's a different approach to filmmaking, not to group, or to minimize everything that Argento is doing within the context of like Italian national cinema, because he very much is his own kind of filmmaker. It's odd because there are certain aspects that really echo with others, but it comes together in a combination that's very unique. He's, first and foremost, he's a stylistic filmmaker. Nobody really watches any of his films for the plot. Instead, it's these ridiculously ornate, like painstakingly composed sequences, very innovative camera work, and especially with his own band Goblin, a very strong emphasis of musical accompaniment on the soundtrack. Like, we were talking earlier that he seems like a filmmaker that constructs sequences first and foremost, and he creates his films by stringing these sequences together. So I think some of his films are hit and miss. Some of them are just flat out weird, like movies like Phenomena cross over more firmly into surrealism than anything. And it occupies just this very strange, like, liminal space on the screen. So then learning more about Argento, realizing that he has an entire first half of his career where he's still a stylistic filmmaker, but covering very different genre and sort of thematic territory. It's interesting. And Deep Red basically acts as sort of the fulcrum between those two tendencies, because this is sort of widely regarded as the last of his straight giallo films, but there's enough in it that you can definitely see where films like Suspiria and Inferno kind of get their, the seeds are planted.
Yeah, very, very much so. And it's, like, I feel, like, I don't want to tip our hand too much. First of all, I think we should say right off the bat, there's no way to discuss this film without spoilers. So we are going to spoil the heck out of it before this is all said and done. So maybe the best way to sort of approach this is to give a general quick plot description of this movie, which should be very, very easy. So the general gist of this film is basically we open up with a murder taking place involving a small child witnessing some sort of horrific act. The way in which it's staged obscures the events a little bit, but it opens up before moving forward in time to a psychic who is giving more or less a discussion and demonstration of her abilities in Italy, in this sort of auditorium for a large crowd, where she senses a killer in their midst.
Yeah, this whole sequence is like the missing link between the 39 Steps and Scanners. And unless I'm mistaken, I think Cronenberg actually has cited this introductory auditorium sequence as a direct influence on the way that the infamous head explosion scene in Scanners was staged.
Interesting. Okay, I wouldn't necessarily have picked up on that because, I mean, there's definitely... I mean, Argento and him have a very different senses of style because... And I guess this is a good point to sort of bring this up. I mean, the way he stages this is this very theatrical, both in design and in performance of a sequence where you sort of go into the room and, you know, this auditorium, it's almost like everybody's looking in on an opera stage, as it were. Like, it's very ornate, it's beautiful, and our psychic has, like, this very dramatic, you know, reaction to the killer in their midst that she can't quite see, but makes all sorts of declarations about. Later in the day, instead of, you know, taking what information she has to the police, she decides she's going to put it off a day.
Get a good night's sleep and then fill out the paperwork.
Yeah, which doesn't go too well because she is then murdered by somebody in a raincoat, an event which is witnessed by Marcus, a British pianist living in Italy, who happens to live just above her and who was down on the ground, you know, consoling his drunkard best friend Carlo. And as he rushes up into the apartment, he goes to take a look and, you know, see if he can save this woman, which he can't.
Spoiler alert. I guess if he could save her, there wouldn't really be much of a film.
This is true. On the other hand, it would also be, like, maybe 20 minutes, which in and of itself would have been perfectly fine. But yes, he finds this, gets up there, the woman is dead, the police become involved, he's convinced there's a detail that he's missing, that he can't quite remember from when he rushed into the room, but he's not sure what it is. And bit by bit, thanks to a reporter, Gianna, played by Daria Nicoldi, I'm probably mispronouncing her name, but she is a long-term staple of Argento's work, and co-wrote Suspiria, and did a heavy amount of uncredited work on
Inferno.
Oh, really?
I did not know that. Yeah. Yes, Daria Nicoldi. Yeah. Or Nicolodi.
Yeah, Nicolodi. But she is, she's a very prominent figure in his filmography, and certainly... in terms of, is the mother of Asia Argento. They were also partners for a good long time before that relationship broke up. She plasters Marcus's image all over the papers because irresponsibility in reporting goes so far.
She highlights that this man, Marcus, happens to be the only witness to the crime, which naturally, well, if you're any kind of killer that wants to avoid detection, you go after the people who can identify you. So Marcus gets pulled into this mystery as a target, and then he begins to decide investigating it on his own accord.
Yes, alongside the person who put him in harm's way at first as well, but hey, he doesn't apparently hold that against her. He just happens to be a raving misogynist early on and sexist jerk. So, hey.
Weren't you the one who said we weren't going to tip our hand, David?
All right, yeah, that's a fair point. We weren't going to tip our hand, but yeah, I'm tipping my hand now. So, my apologies. At any rate, this investigation and mystery leads to... Should we just outline the rest of the plot now, do you think, Andrew? Should we hold it back at this point?
Yeah, we may as well outline. So along the course of this investigation, we discover homosexual self-loathing. We discover crazy Sunset Boulevard-style failed actresses. We discover animal cruelty. We discover convenient plaster work. And then we discover that the killer... the killer can be identified because of a drawing they made at their old school, which Marcus eventually sleuths out was made by his friend Carlos, who, in the moment of confrontation, is summarily killed in a almost comically gruesome manner. But then, and only then, do we discover in the film's final moments, Carlo wasn't actually the killer or the only killer. It's somewhat unclear. but that Carlo's mother was the one all this time. And the opening flashback of childhood trauma is Carlo and his mother, and basically how they got their big break in the burgeoning field of murder.
Yes, in this bafflingly almost parodic Christmas, you know, tableau that they seem to exist in. Oh god, that sequence is so weird. But
don't forget the music.
Yeah, oh yeah, and it's all scored to the glory of Goblin and this weird child rhyme. Oh, and that also winds us, don't forget, there's also wind-up toy slash killer slasher robot, I think, is involved.
Oh yeah, Clownbot. Clownbot 3.0.
Yeah, so, So, if that sounds simultaneously paper-thin and all over the map there, folks,
Yeah, see, I mean, anyone who's listened to the episodes we've done previously knows that sometimes we'll describe a film as bonkers, and we usually mean that as a term of compliment and a term of love. Street Fighter is a bonkers film, for instance, where it's not a good movie, but there's so much craziness going on that it's hard for it not to be delightful. Going by a pure listing of things that happen in this film, I would describe Deep Red as pretty bonkers, but in the experience of watching it, you walk away with a very different feeling than you do with Street Fighter, and granted, that may be an odd way to phrase this film, because it sounds like, oh, well, it doesn't live up to the lofty cinematic heights of Street Fighter. but this is admittedly a pretty weird movie.
Yeah, it is a weird movie, and weird isn't necessarily a bad thing, as I think we've made it clear in past episodes. Idiosyncratic is not a bad thing either, necessarily, when it comes to films either. I mean, we've clearly expressed our love for things as peculiar as Dead Man, and certainly, you know, we're not against, you know, what would be considered sort of art house cinema or, you know, stuff that is not conforming to any sort of conventional logic or storytelling parameters. Having said that, as I was telling you, Andrew, right before the podcast we started recording this thing, I only really came to Argento last year. He is somebody, you know, I've heard about and I've often read about, but I've never actually seen his work and decided to finally change that.
See, that surprises me, David, because for some reason, Argento always struck me as a filmmaker that you would be excited by.
And you would, I'm not going to lie, you would think that. I mean, for a variety of reasons, there's a lot of things that about Argento that on paper should appeal to me. One, he seems to have a deep love of progressive rock and roll, so by all means, I'm with you there, pal. And yeah, his movies are great to listen to. He also has a very, you know, great visual focus sort of designed his movies.
There's almost something painterly about it.
Absolutely. And I will say, his movies are, on the whole, including this one, gorgeous. I can't speak for his more recent stuff, which, from what I understand, that is no longer the case. But, you know, I will say this right off the bat. I didn't choose to take a look at his Dracula for our next movie, so anybody kind of hoping for that, I'm sorry. Maybe one day we'll get to that via the route of Rutger Hauer. But yeah, no, he's got, you know, this beautiful visual style. And again, I'm somebody who tends to, you know, like, you know, to a degree, you know, what would be considered like classic exploitation cinema. Stuff that is sort of the, you know, it's sort of, I don't want to say it's disreputable, because I think one of the things that we tend to see amongst horror filmmakers in the horror community is there's a sense of, oh, we're the disreputable genre. You know, we're the outsiders, all this. And I think that is something that horror cinema, particularly in this day and age, is overplaying to a large
degree. It's like wearing it as a badge, you know? It's the same reason why some comedians, in scare quotes, on Twitter, they think that offending somebody is like the noblest pursuit that there can be. But it's like, if you're simply making a film to repulse your audience, that's actually not difficult to do at all. There definitely is that element of kind of like the exploitative aspect, especially in a film like Deep Red. But I think overall, like, there's a world of difference between Deep Red and, say, the original I Spit on Your Grave, for instance. But, like,
yeah,
it straddles this weird line where there's definitely, I think because this film has such an emphasis on its formalism and its aesthetics, it's like, this film is equal parts I Spit on Your Grave and, like, Fondo Elise, for instance. It belongs, it has one foot firmly, like, in genre territory, but even without being necessarily a high-budget, like, high-gloss production, there definitely is a lot of art house sensibility and a lot of attention to detail that you generally don't find in contemporaneous films like Deep Red.
Well, no, absolutely. And this is the thing where trying to wrap my mind around this film, because I will flat out say, I didn't mind it while I was watching it. Like, I didn't have a passionate reaction one way or another to this film. And ultimately, I sort of came to the same conclusion that I've had with pretty close to every Argento movie I've seen, which is, it looks not pretty, it sounds great, I just, as an actual piece of narrative cinema, and what's going in is a holistic work overall, I just don't really care for it. And the more I think about it, the more it bugs me. And I've been trying to put my finger on what it is about this particular film, because there are all sorts of little elements about this movie that don't work for me. And I can say, you know, are problems for me overall, and which, you know, get more increasingly ridiculous. But, and the thing is about it is, though, is when we go through them, and we will go through them, this is stuff where in another filmmaker's hands, it might not bother me. And again, amongst the ones we were sort of talking about prior to this, I mean, David Lynch is a filmmaker who isn't, you know, is often drifts into surreal territory. And although he can tell, you know, sort of conventional, you know, or do conventional storytelling techniques by anybody who's seen stuff like The Straight Story or even The Elephant Man,
mm-hmm.
Which sort of rides that fine line between being sort of a commercial, you know, Hollywood film and his art house sensibilities. Lynch can do those things. But he can also, you know, this is the guy who gave us Inland Empire and Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, which, newsflash, are not going to make a lot of sense when you watch them right through. And
even if you've seen the entire run of Twin Peaks, I mean, Fire Walk With Me, still, it's not going to make any more sense. But yeah, like, Lynch, his approach to writing, though, he's big into transcendental meditation, and that interest kind of manifests on the screen, where his films aren't driven necessarily by, like, the normal causal rationality that most other narrative filmmaking is. And I think if we look at something like Farewell, My Lovely again, and compare that to Deep Red, in a sense, they're covering similar ground, where, you know, there's a crime, there's the investigation. Farewell, My Lovely, though, belongs to that distinct, like, classic Hollywood style, where everything is a rational and logical result of something that happens previously. Like, it proceeds sequentially, and eventually everything's resolved. Whereas filmmakers like Lynch and Argento, there's less emphasis on causality or even, like, logical operational order, and I don't want to use the word surrealist, because that is a very distinct mode of art, and yes. I don't think it totally applies here, but rather they occupy a kind of liminal, like, dreamlike space, where some things will happen that are kind of unmoored from rationality. Like, in Deep Red, I think the biggest thing is that Marcus, he gets a feeling that something is off when he returns to the apartment, or that something is different about that first crime scene, and he can't remember what. And most of the film is him just occasionally stopping to try and remember what is different. And, like, it's a weird setup where it's like, I know I have the answer within me, it's just I need to think hard enough and I will find it. But as a result, like, even the way he goes about investigating the house and just happening to find this folktale about a haunted mansion and a crying child, like, it all seems to proceed, I don't want to say by convenience or coincidence, more like by contingency, that his intuition leads him in places when, if you're trying to look at rationally, it doesn't make sense.
Well, this is the thing, and I will take the step back and say, to sort of go back to the Lynch comparisons, here's where, you know, not just Lynch, but even something like another film I watched recently, which I enjoyed much more, which was the Neil Young Dean Stockwell film Human Highway. I sat down and watched it, and that film makes no logical sense whatsoever while you're watching it, for the most part. Having said that, what I think the distinction between, you know, Lynch and, you know, Human Highway is from, say, Dario Argento, as I see it, is there is something, and I use this to describe Human Highway, which is they are authentically weird movies. I watch those films, and I don't think for one second David Lynch or, you know, Neil Young and Dean Stockwell could have made anything else. This is just the way their brains work. And the way in which that personality gets expressed on screen brings sort of a unity to those films in a way that doesn't quite exist, I think, with Argento. Like, David Lynch, you may not get the logic, you may not get the flow of his films, but I never have the sense that he isn't somebody who isn't in total control in doing something, you know, just for the hell of it. He's got a rationale and a reason for what he's doing.
And whether or not it's the idea of who David Lynch is as represented in culture or analysis, I mean, going back to the idea of the auteur, there is something palpably Lynchian about his films. And as the old joke says, you know, I might not be able to tell you what it is, but I know it when I see it.
Yeah, and Argento, the thing about it is you're right, he, to come back to your earlier comment, I think there are individual sequences that he's great. There are stuff that he loves, and, you know, when he's getting to do those things, it works wonderfully for him. The problem is that he has no way to integrate the things that he doesn't care about in a meaningful way. And any attempt, and the problem is unlike, say, Lynch, where his, you know, entire reality has this sort of warped, you know, anything can happen element to it in a way, which is, you know, a complete reduction of what Lynch is doing. But to bear with me here, folks, for a second, you know, Argento basically applies degrees of logic from in structures from genres that are antithetical to what he's doing, and he can't make those things work together. As he's going through. So hence we have this paper-thin mystery that, you know, only works, as you've said here, because of basically our main character's intuition that doesn't really add up to much. And it invites, you know, psychological readings that it doesn't support, because Argento isn't actually interested in anything remotely close to how the real human brain works in this movie. But the veneer of his, you know, his art house approach to things makes it look like it's a much smarter and much, you know, more meaningful film than it is. And once you start digging into the subtext and the text of it, there really isn't much there. And that, I think, is fundamentally what is driving me up the wall with these films. It's, you can't commit to being completely bonkers in a way that is just strictly entertaining, or I can't believe he's doing this. But he also, at the same time, can't actually, you know, support the pretensions that he's, or, and I hate using the word pretentious, but he can't really support the loftiness that his films are seem to be implying and at least suggesting to its audience.
Well, I think I'd like to go back a bit to what you said, where one of the central differences between Argento and similar filmmakers is sort of that holisticness of the film, and like a unity of tone and a unity of style. And especially in Deep Red, you know, I used the word like a sequential film in a way earlier, and I think that really does apply here, and that might speak to one of the problems, where if you look at this film, like, okay, it seems there are two kinds of scenes. There are mostly static dialogue scenes. Marcus and Carlo, for instance. Mark and the reporter, what's her name again as a character? Gianna.
Gianna?
Yes. And a lot of them are filmed more or less conventionally. Yeah. It's... You know, they're basically those kinds of scenes that any filmmaker could make, provided that they had a bare understanding of how to shoot a dialogue scene. But then we get the murder sequences. And then not only is there basically an exponential explosion in all the different visual things going on. We see POV tracking shots. We see these weird Steadicam shots of the camera hovering around characters in private spaces. But even the use of score, Goblin soundtrack, that pops up in these sequences. And it feels stylistically and tonally very much at odds from the rest of the film around it. It gives the impression that, yeah, this really is a film that's built around set pieces. And as a result, like, the set pieces themselves, they work really well, and I think they're pretty masterfully composed, but they're completely at odds with the rest of the film. And so, like, there's something unsatisfying about watching a film that, even though it does certain things well, like, kind of foregrounds itself as an exhibition, or like a sizzle reel, in a sense. Where it's like, okay, come here for, 90 minutes of meandering dialogue and awkward attempts at screwball romance, but really what we're coming here is for that half hour where it becomes a different film. It's just very odd, you know? I think that maybe speaks to where this film comes out in Argento's own filmography, sort of moving from one mode into another. But the result is, it's kind of haphazard, and it feels strange to use that word to describe a film where there are moments where everything is so tightly controlled, and everything is gridded out, and the mise-en-scene is placed just so. But it's like they did that for half of the movie and didn't really care about all the connective tissue in between.
Well, that's exactly it. And there's so much downtime spent on that connective tissue where it's clear Argento's heart just isn't in it. And it's so basically, you know, just get me to the next bit, get me to the next bit, that it does, you know, he doesn't put the care and attention that is required there. Because, I mean, in a good example of this is there's a sequence late in the movie and I keep coming back to, but it feels like, first of all, one of the major plot points at the end of this movie hinges upon the fact that the room in which this, the opening murder took place was on this beautiful estate. And what our character comes to Marcus comes to realize is that, as he's staring at the photo from the book that he, or from this, photo from a book that he'd ripped out, at a library, so public defacing public property, good work. He compares it and realizes, oh, a window's missing, and comes to realize that, yeah, there's been this mysteriously boarded up, walled up room that nobody can access. So this leads to a sequence where, for reasons I'm still not sure, rather than just go inside and see if he can find the boarded up room or find out where this missing room would be in the layout, he decides to climb the wall so he can bang into the plaster, which leads to a moment of false tension where it looks like he might fall, and the Goblin soundtrack kicks in, and the rest of the sequence is him crawling down a wall while, you know, the Goblin basically rocks out on the soundtrack for like 5 minutes. Just as we watch David Hemmings crawl down a wall. Does it add anything to the plot of this movie? No. Does it further anything? No. Yeah. As an individual sequence, is it impressive? Not really. It's like, you know, it's like, okay, I need to buffer out the time of this movie. So, hey, David Hemmings, go climb a wall. It's okay. But then, you know, that
well,
would
it
be
makes
one
sense
thing,
in other like sequences, but this one, it's just tonally at odds because the action on screen is nowhere near deserving of a score this ornate.
Well, and the thing about it is this happens in almost all of his films as well. There is a sequence, I watched Inferno shortly after this one as well, and there's a sequence where a character, you know, Keith Emerson's, you know, really great iconic piece from that film, Blair's over sequence where a dude is crawling beneath floorboards and then finds this midden sort of stairwell. And then he walks down the stairwell. And it is like the most epic music you can imagine. And I think what Argento wants is it to be like this, you know, descent into hell. But it's like, no, he found this, you know, pretty basic stairwell. Watch him as he slowly walks down it for reasons.
But what could be at the bottom of the stairs? We need to get people tense, and that's where the score comes in. But there are a few moments where, like, that stylization becomes a bit overbearing. It's, I remember, okay, people hassle me about it all the time, but I love Randy Newman, okay? And not just for the Pixar soundtracks. But I remember hearing an interview where they were asking him about film score, and he pointed out that Woody Allen's Manhattan is an example of what not to do, because he was saying that, like, so many sequences, like, there's this bombastic, the Gershwin score coming in over top of it. You see all these towering buildings, and then it just cuts down to little Woody Allen talking about relationship problems. And, like, it doesn't quite seem to fit. And I think the bulk of the hyper-stylized, the kill sequences, really, in this film, they do work. But then, yeah, there's that weird, oh, so I guess David Hemming's maybe falling a dozen feet is on the same level as a wind-up clown doll running out of the shadows?
Well, and this is the thing about it is, you know, for a film that is, I mean, it'd be one thing to come back to these sequences, because you're right, these kill sequences are grandiose and kind of epic in the way they're staged, and highly stylized, and yet the way in which Argento chooses to, you know, sort of construct, you know, a narrative around featuring these sequences is to create this mystery that makes, is first of all, initiated by an event that really doesn't make sense, is built around a mystery that doesn't add up, and features so many bloody plot holes that, I mean, if you're actually thinking about what you're watching, you're just going to get really, really frustrated really quickly.
I'm
going to
call your bluff right there. Instead of saying that this film doesn't make sense and has plot holes, give me some examples. I want to get into the parts of your notes that were written in all caps.
Okay, so let's start. Ultimately, as I was noting, there is this boarded up mysterious room in this household. Now, you would think, obviously, okay, that's something that you would see in, you know, many different types of movies. What is kind of odd, however, is when David Hemmings breaks through the wall to get into this room, he discovers there's a corpse in there. Now, as we come to discover, Carlo's mom is the killer. This is the house she had with her husband. How on earth did she get this wall plastered up and boarded and blocked off, same with the window, and not one person noticed that there is a dead body?
It's DIY renovation, Dave. Don't you watch Home and Garden television? People do it all the time.
But again, she's, you know, this woman who is, like, by herself, you know, is she buying the plaster, bringing it in? Like, nobody's questioning why somebody who clearly has the wealth to have a home like this can't employ somebody to do it? Like, why did this happen?
Well, the film kind of tempers, like, that logical explanation, because every moment that we see Carlo's mother in the film, she's presented as a little off at best and full-blown crazy for the rest of it. So, I mean, of all the people to suddenly very discreetly plaster up part of their house, probably not going to be her to do it.
Yeah, exactly. And then we get to things such as, as we keep referring to it, the wind-up robot kill thing. One, where did she get this? Okay, did she build it? Or, you know, did she buy it? If she bought it, who is supplying, you know, these killer wind-up robot clown dolls? Because believe me, there is a far more interesting movie going on somewhere if that's the case. But putting it aside, how did she get it into the room that is in there? Why did she feel she needed to have that in the first place? Because, like, did she feel she needed a random distraction because reasons? Did she climb up the wall of this building in order to get into his apartment to place the doll and then hide behind a curtain? Like,
yeah. And for all the element of surprise, it's like, well, before I kill anyone, though, I need to make absolutely sure that I pull out my my proto-Walkman and start playing that creepy song again.
Yeah, exactly. And then, not to mention, the entirety of this film is predicated on the notion that we have a psychic who can sense a killer in her midst. Number one, as it's shot and edited, as she's making this declaration, we see a POV of what is presumably the killer getting up and leaving the room.
And she even points out, the killer knows that I'm talking about him, and now he's getting up to leave.
Yeah, you would think that somebody would probably write down the details of, hey, I caught this individual here. Might want to remember this in case this becomes a police matter.
Well, because there's also like 20 people in the theater. So, I mean, it's not exactly a big pool of people that it could be.
Exactly. And then on top of which, our psychic then has to make the boneheaded decision of like, okay, you know, I could, you know, having now made this big public display, you know, probably go to a safe, secure location or, you know, go immediately to the police who, yeah, maybe they won't buy that I'm a psychic, but at least they might take seriously enough to believe that, you know, something's going on. And say it's like, nah, I'm just going to rest at my home apartment and, you know, take it easy. And apparently at this point, her psychic abilities, which could sense a killer in a giant crowd of people, are utterly useless.
Well, you know, she gave at the office, you know? It's, I mean, by that same token, like, when Marcus gets involved in the murder, he decides he'll investigate it himself. Even though he's surrounded by police, they're constantly checking in with him, he decides to go his own way. And, like, that's sort of the more lazy narrativizing, I find, because it's like, those are moments where it's like, well, this happens because the plot requires this to happen. Because, like, yeah. If she went to the police, we wouldn't have that first kill scene, and without the first kill scene, we don't have the subsequent ones. I think, like, plot holes in that I can sort of forgive. I think the bigger issue comes from just the overall strength of the script itself. Because this is a film that I think narratively wears its influences pretty prominently on its sleeve. I think there's two big ones, and one I'm almost ashamed that I sort of blanked on for so long. But the clear analog is Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. We have a series of like stylized POV knife murders. We have a troubled young man and his overbearing mother. And only the real difference is it turns out that mother actually is alive and she is killing people. It's not just the son. Spoilers for that one as well. But I think what's more interesting is the other influence, and that would be Michelangelo Antonioni's film Blow Up, which also stars David Hemmings. Yeah. And that's a film about a photographer who may have inadvertently photographed a murder, and through technology magnification that, he keeps going back to debate and decipher himself whether or not he actually saw what he thinks he saw. And, I mean, Blow Up is a film that every 101 film studies program will teach you, because it's all about the crisis of the image and whether or not photographic proof of something is the same thing as epistemological truth. You know, so Blow Up does something very similar to Deep Red. The only difference is here, it's Mark continually going back to his memories, being like, what did I see? Did I really see it? And so it comes off as kind of hokey and sort of accidental, where even after everything's okay, he gets back home, and then he just stops and kind of looks off screen, furrows his brow, and he's like, wait a second, now I remember what I saw, just in time for the final plot reveal.
Yeah, it turns out, yeah, that he thinks for the early part that a painting has been removed from the wall. Turns out, nope, it was a person in a mirror that he passed by as he was going there, which happens to have been the killer. And the killer, as he discovers, is Carlos's mom, who goes off on a tangent about, you know, why she's killing and things and how Marcus should have left things alone.
And now it's all his fault. Which, I guess it's always lovely, transitive guilt. To the film's credit, though, in that initial run through the apartment, if you look, there is that brief shot tracking down the hallway, and you do see her face in the mirror. So at least the film's consistent with that. But
it's consistent with that. It's just that the fact that the way this everything's set up is, it invites you to look at the psychologies of these characters and these sort of cause and effect of things, and it not only does it not add up, it's so broad and caricature in its approach. Like, it's not, it doesn't, I mean, you can sit there and talk about, you know, the ending of Psycho and how Hitchcock may or may not be parodying modern psychology's ability to explain away evil.
Well, yeah, because for those who haven't seen it, I mean, the final 10 minutes of Psycho is literally sitting with a doctor who sits down and explains Norman Bates' entire pathology, why he is the way he is, and what has led him to do this. Deep Red doesn't have that moment, really. Like, we're supposed to infer it, but based off what the film gives us to infer upon, like, It seems to suggest a very facile, you know, classically Freudian psychoanalytic motivation for everything, where Carlo witnesses his mother commit murder when he's young. The mother does it because she was the actress that gave up her career for love, and then her husband wanted to institutionalize him. They have this shared secret that they carry through the ages, and then Carlo, or they start killing again to cover their secret. And incidentally, Carlo is also a homosexual, and he's presented as somewhat guilt-ridden, but it's also, the film seems to imply that, well, this is also the result of a domineering mother.
Well, and this is the problem that really irks me. I mean, maybe I could forgive some of the other things and go with it as a fun romp, but there is such a strongly, not only homophobic, but misogynist streak to this movie. In a way that is really, really uncomfortable. Because the thing about Argento is, we have given him a lot of praise here for the, you know, sort of spectacular way in which he executes the murder sequences of these films, where it is very much this sort of ornate artwork that he's putting together. At the same time, pretty much all the major victims in this movie are women. And the ones that aren't, their death sequences are notably shorter and not nearly as graphic or prolonged in terms of their grotesqueness of the violence itself. And in this, no, he like openly, you know, photographs the murder of women in this almost disturbingly loving approach. That is just really uncomfortable, which then gets compounded by, as we sort of note here, this sort of weird cause and effect that, you know, it's not, I mean, it'd be one thing, you know, Carlo isn't, you know, simply the fact that he is a gay character, you know, and a self-loathing one isn't, you know, just a character aspect of it. It's just not something where, you know, it's, you know, just a detail of his life or something that we need to consider. It's presented like it's a clue. This is something we didn't know about him.
Well,
and,
you know,
that makes us suspicious, and that is deeply troubling itself. Not to mention the way in which his death at the end of the film is, you know, so over the bloody top, and done almost like for a laugh.
Yeah, it comes off as almost slapsticky. But, I mean, okay, not to take the opposite position. But I would say that, I mean, this is also 1975, and, you know, even though I don't think either of us would agree with it, it's not wrong to say that Hollywood and global filmmaking have always found that gay people, or whatever could be grouped under, you know, then what was termed as sexual deviancy, it tends to go hand in hand with villainy on screen. And, like, abhorrent or abnormal or non-normative for its time sexuality often is linked with villainous characters. Like, you can look back at Joel Cairo in The Maltese Falcon or Angela in Sleepaway Camp, you know, where it's like it's not enough for this character to be ostracized as they, you know, as even, like, plot devices like that in films guarantee will continue to happen, but it's the fact that, okay, well, it's not enough that they're just a homosexual. They also have to be deeply compromised or flawed in some other way, and we can't even feel sympathy because that's what motivates them to do evil to others. And, you know, it's whether or not you want to be like, well, Argento is just a filmmaker of his time, that doesn't necessarily mean it's something we have to agree with either. The misogyny in this film, though, I think there are a few moments where it kind of undercuts that, or, like, Marcus's attempts to assert himself almost come off as self-parody, and I think in a deliberate way. But it's also interesting to see the comparatively regressive presentation of gender roles in this film, especially when you consider that Argento's most notable films are female-driven.
Well, it is, and it's one of these things where having, again, sort of, you know, mainlined a whole whack of his films of late, I'm not entirely sure how much credit I'm willing to give him, even in those instances. Because, I mean, I'll put it this way. There is, I should clarify this before. Now, there are multiple different cuts of Deep Red that are out there, which we haven't addressed. Now, Andrew, which one did you watch?
Okay, so I was trying to shag it down. I believe I have the... I think it's the original cut, because it's 2 hours long. Some of the scenes that you said were missing from your version are in there. And yeah, it wasn't put out by Anchor Bay, and I'm pretty sure that they exclusively released the trimmed down director's cut.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing, because, I don't even know, not even sure whether I want to call it a director's cut per se. I just, from what I've been able to find online, the American release with the American language soundtrack that was put out by, I believe, Fox in 1975. Not Fox. That was Suspiria that was released by Fox. But anyways, the release that was put out in 1975 is Argento's preferred version, and it cut a lot of the stuff with... the reporter out. So really the only scene in the version I watched that sort of acknowledges, you know, and calls Marcus on his sort of sexist attitudes is the arm wrestling scene, where he makes some ridiculous, overtly sexist statements. And then the reporter's like, oh yeah, that's what you think. And then she one-ups him twice mm-hmm. in an arm wrestling match, which is fun, except it's the only scene, at least in the version I'm watching, which calls him out on his BS. And it's not like that's an overall character arc that really changes for him over the course of the film. Other than the fact that, you know, he becomes more willing to cooperate with her in terms of investigating the situation. But that feels almost motivated by necessity rather than, oh, he's evolving as a person.
Yeah, like his arc in the film, he doesn't really have one beyond he's drawn into a mystery and then he solves it. He doesn't want other people's help. And then he gets it, but then he still has to do it on his own by the end, and his great victory is beheading an old woman. I think that also speaks to the fact that Marcus doesn't really have a character. I mean, none of the characters are fully formed or realizable. Considering that he's the protagonist of the film, all we know about him is that he's a piano player, he teaches in the conservatory, he's lived abroad, and currently lives in Italy. And other than, like, that introduction to him, where he chastises the members of the jazz band for playing dirty jazz a little too formally, because after all, this music came from the brothels, like, we're not given much insight. Beyond these sequences with Gianna, where, like, it's not... These films, and especially Gianna's own, like, response to it as a character, she almost feels like she's acting in a different movie, where she is very almost, like, gadfly-ish about it, and everything's just sort of entertaining to her. And, like, even, like, I think she gives the best performance in the movie, because there are those little details, like her in the crowded cafe trying to yell a message to Marcus on the phone, and the server walks by, she just grabs him by his hair, pulls him over, gives him the message, and then blows him a kiss to send him on his way. Like, I like her. She's spunky, she's fun, she's good at arm wrestling. But it's, like, because maybe it's a linguistic thing, maybe Marcus as a character is supposed to be sort of out of sync with everybody around him. Like, thematically that makes sense, but it's hard to tell whether or not that's just a failure of chemistry or if the film's meant to be this way. I did find it really amusing, though, later. It might have been cut from yours when they're in the car talking about what they're going to do. And Gianna basically says, look, you need my help. I'm going to help you. This is after arm wrestling. And then Marcus basically says, oh, you can't help me. Women, they're all about brute power. We need a plan with brains that only a man can give. And, like, moments like that are so over the top. I feel like we're supposed to take that comedically. But when the film when the film's pushback against its own misogynistic tendencies is like a gag, a smile, and an eye roll, and then goes back to more of the same, I mean, it's pretty hard to say that this film balances itself.
Well, no, absolutely. And I mean, it, you know, it really becomes problematic when you start considering the other weird details which add to sort of the uncomfortable subtext in misogyny of the film, such as when Marcus goes to find the house that it turns out Carlos and his mother lived in, where that initial murder took place. He visits what I'm not sure if it's just the caretaker or the slash owner realtor who has it, but there's this encounter with his daughter, who is this little child who, you know, she gets slapped around by her father, which Marcus does nothing about, number one. But number two, turns out it's because, oh, she is just openly, you know, committing animal cruelty to things, where it's just such a weird, weird detail where it's like, oh, and here's another woman who is committing heinous acts because reasons?
Well, yeah, I think especially if you view that in context of how the film concludes, doesn't seem accidental, and it seems to be suggesting, you know, the concept of original sin, that sin is brought into the world by a woman, that this little girl, just for because reasons, has decided to suddenly start torturing small lizards. The same way that, okay, well, Carlo may have been involved in all these terrible crimes, but really it's his mom's fault, so let's blame her, you know? It really kind of feels like, for all this film's bluster, at the end of the day, all it's really trying to say is, huh, women, can't live with them, am I right?
Well, and that's exactly the problem with it, is ultimately that, even if I could find some fun to be had with some of this, like, I mean, and again, one of the things I compared to, I was talking about briefly in our notes, was the idea of the Friday the 13th films. I am not a fan overall of the Friday the 13th series. I don't get them for the most part in terms of what it is that fans find super exciting about them, because they're basically next to nothing films and just excuses due to gore effects. But having said that, there is a sensibility about them where they're made with, number one, there's no pretension about what they are. They are just straight ahead junk. And for the most part, they know they're junk. They're there to, you know, we're going to do some gore gags. We're going to kill a bunch of random, you know, young actors who are on the cusp of maybe becoming something, or more likely going nowhere with their careers. And it's kind of equal opportunity in terms of how it treats those characters. I mean, you know, Kevin Bacon gets just as ridiculous a death scene as many of the other female characters in those films. And again, it's kind of hard to take them as offering much in the way of sort of an attitude towards anything in those things, other than, you know, we're just here for a good time and just, you know, rock and roll through this in about 90 minutes or less. Argento, because in part there is that auteurist vibe about him, the fact that we are seeing somebody's personal artwork, as it were, as given that he's, you know, writing and direct, or co-writing in this instance, and directing it. And there is that sort of the veneer of the art house to it. It seems like it earns a much more, it deserves a more critical reading.
I think that's fair, though, because when there is that attention to certain aspects of the film, like the entire stylistic register, I mean, it begs the question of, okay, but what are we putting all this effort and attention towards in the service of? And when all you can sort of come away in the narrative register is that, well, women are kind of a mixed bag, aren't they? It doesn't feel satisfying. Like, based off what the film gives us, like, you know, and, I mean, we argued about this before with movies like Heat, where it's not necessarily a critical requirement that a film needs something to say, but realistically, I mean, considering how hard it is to make a film, there's got to be a reason for why this film is being made. And that almost makes me wonder if, like, Argento's interest really does begin and end in the aesthetic register. Like, maybe he just gets a vision of what a really amazing kill scene would be, and then he, like, reverse engineers a script based off of that. Like, with a film like Deep Red, it really does kind of come off like that might have been the approach.
Well, and this is why the more I see, like, of all the films I've seen, I mean, of his so far, I almost want to say he's like the Italian art house version of Michael Bay. He, you know, visually magnificent, but he has no interest in telling a story. He has no vibe about creating a world. He doesn't really care about character. It's just, you know, here are some pretty visuals, and that's fine. You'd maybe be better served, you know, making prog rock music videos,
yeah,
with, you know, Goblin rather than making big, long theatrical films.
But that's the thing about analysis, where in doing it, we realize that author's intent has no bearing on the effect produced by that film. So even if, you know, like the film's misogyny is really just a result of like disinterest in any kind of larger narrative point, I mean, that's still what we're left with on screen at the end of the day.
No, absolutely. And I mean, it's frustrating because I know, you know, it's not that we're going to get hate mail, because I don't think anybody pays enough attention to us to give us hate mail.
Not but, yet, I mean, but soon.
Yeah. Yes. Except maybe James. We'll see what we get from him as a response. But the point of the matter is,
send your postcards directly to David.
Why am I getting so much mail? How am I getting so much mail? It's not like I published my address. But anyways, but yeah, no, I think in some ways I kind of feel bad, because I know Argento is held in such high regard amongst genre fans in a way, but I just can't help but feel like this is honestly a case where I think I'm just bouncing off of a filmmaker who just isn't for me. And that's the case. I mean, that's fine. I mean, you know, more power to those who love his work. I don't think that his status in the genre and in filmmaking in general is really earned by what I've witnessed. And it's not like, you know, the films I've watched are a mixture of what is basically everybody considers his low period of recent years versus, you know, his, you know, high points. I've seen most of the high points so far.
And even compared to the trilogy, the Mother of Tears trilogy, like, people still routinely will list Deep Red as Argento's high watermark. And that's why coming back to it this time felt like a very different film. And, I mean, in your defense, Dave, I know you've seen and enjoyed films by, like, sort of filmmakers within that same period and within that same movement, Italian filmmakers. Lucio Fulci is one, Mario Bava is another. So it's not necessarily like, oh, well, it's just a fish out of water scenario. It's, I mean, Argento's not the only Italian filmmaker to try his hand at sort of a aestheticized supernatural horror storytelling through the 1970s and 80s. It's, yeah, I mean, it this time around, I did find it a lot less satisfying. And I think maybe that just might be a decade more of film immersion. But at the same time, I will say, I wouldn't say this is a bad film. Like, I would say solely for its aesthetics alone, it's worth paying attention to. And I guess in that regard, there's one thing that I would like to highlight. And that would be just the stylistic influences that this film would then have over following horror films. Because John Carpenter's Halloween, that's 1978?
Yes.
Okay. I am pretty well convinced that most of the kill scenes in this film, especially the use of POV and the overbearing omnipresent score composed by the director himself, like, that directly informs certain parts of Halloween.
It informs it. I just think Carpenter does it better, because number one, the score to Halloween is, the difference being his minimalist approach, you know, doesn't overwhelm the film in the same way that, as much as the music here is great, it can overwhelm sequences of this movie where it just doesn't feel like it belongs. And Carpenter, I think, like I said, is, again, his integration of those into a cohesive narrative, it just functions so much better in that film compared to what's here. So, yeah, I'm not going to doubt Argento's influence. I think this is just the case of, you know, again, we took the ball, you know, the filmmakers who took the ball from him and ran with it did just ultimately a much better job at the end of the day than he did.
Well, yeah, it's, I mean, that's the thing. Like, whenever we hear something was influenced by something else, you go back to the original and you're like, you know, it's like when I played Mass Effect after I played Mass Effect 2, where I'm like, well, I see why everybody loved this, but I've also had the better version of that.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's not to say Argento's only value is like sort of the stylistic blueprint for the wave of American slasher films that followed. You know, I think his style certainly is unique, and it is problematic. I think you're right in saying that this film's script probably consisted of like a one-page treatment. You know, but like, I feel Argento is not a filmmaker you go to get like deep, psychologically rewarding films. It's more about creating a sort of mood and a sort of feel. And in that way, there's something almost musical about it. And by that same token, I don't think it's purely an accident that Marcus is a pianist in this film.
Well, no, and I mean, it's, again, that's one of those recurring tropes throughout his work is, you know, the Argento protagonist is usually a creative type of some sort. Certainly, again, in Inferno, we have a music student who is ostensibly the protagonist after we get through protagonists 1 and 2 in that movie.
And Suspiria, you know, that takes place at, like, a ballet school, right?
Yeah, and then Tenebrae, if I'm pronouncing that title correctly, is a case where, you know, it's about a writer. And that's the best Argento film I might add. That's the one is the outlier in all this. That's the one that works for me.
Okay, I haven't seen Tenebrae, so, or at least I don't remember seeing it, so it's just as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, it's interesting just as a snapshot, though, because the seeds in Deep Red would not only go on to inform a lot of Argento's work to the present. And, you know, he has continued making films, usually staying more firmly within, like, the horror supernatural aspect of things. But, like, Mother of Tears, that came out in, like, 2013 or so, didn't it? Like, within the last decade. So he's still currently a practicing filmmaker, and Suspiria has been in the news because apparently it's being remade, and the 10-minute clip that they screened for critics, people were leaving because they were going to be ill. So, you know, you can see in Deep Red a lot of traits that would emerge in Argento's later films, and in terms of, like, commercial horror slasher films as well. So in that regard, like, it's interesting to see where it comes from. It's just strange that looking back on it, and I think, you know, understanding a bit more about film history and probably watching Blow Up half a dozen times in between then and now, I'm like, it's hard to see this film's script as anything more than a pastiche. And, you know, I'm a narrative-driven guy. I like people that can tell a story and tell it through the cinematic medium in a way that only cinema can. Yes, I know that's the specificity thesis, and I've been yelled at enough for it. But I like stories. And for me, at the end of the day, I'm never going to be completely satisfied with a Michael Bay-type film where it's so great to look at and absolutely middling to watch.
It, for me, sometimes it can be a case-by-case scenario. Like, there are ones where, I admit, a film is, you know, maybe just visually beautiful, and for whatever reason, that clicks with me. I just think that this film, it's trying so hard and inviting so many, you know, perspectives to be brought to it that it just doesn't hold up to that, the weight of those expectations. I mean, but then again, I say that, and, you know, I went into Argento's supernatural films thinking, well, okay, now that the weight of, you know, total logic is off of his shoulders, like in the case of A Murder Mystery, where things don't necessarily have to completely add up in the same way, maybe those will work. And in a strange way, they're almost worse, because Argento, you know, with even less of a structure, he seems to even be more indulgent and descend into incoherency in a way that really doesn't add up to much.
Yeah, like, so Deep Red is problematic, but it doesn't rely on Donald Pleasance and a razor-wielding orangutan to save the day. But, like, there's definitely a lot of interesting ideas, and I think particularly people that are interested in film style, I think looking at Argento, particularly the way that he brings that sort of late 70s art house sensibility into the field of horror, I think is fairly unique, and I think it's fairly important as well. And just, yeah, it's... I just feel like, you know, this film... It's a film that doesn't conclude, it ends.
Yeah.
And yeah, like the final 2 minutes of the film is Carlo's mom getting beheaded by the elevator, and the reflection of Marcus's face in the pool of blood on the floor as the credits roll. And in a way, like, that kind of signals the disinterest in doing anything deeper with the film's plot, because the plot gets set in motion by a murder, and then when the murderer is caught, that's literally where the film stops. Like, there's no greater statement being made, nor is one, you know, really required to be made as far as the filmmakers are concerned. And, yeah, I mean, like, that's not to say a good potboiler needs to do that. You can say the exact same thing about Farewell, My Lovely, right? That, you know, the film gets a 10-second coda, and it works. It's just, I don't know, for some reason here, maybe because it's trying to do... This strikes me as a film that it wants to fly to the moon, but it doesn't know how to tie its shoelaces.
Well, it's like it doesn't even know how to build a rocket ship to get there. I mean, you're wanting to get somewhere without doing the legwork required. And it's frustrating because it's just, you can tell there was probably a half-decent movie in there somewhere. And, you know, I'm going to get flack for this, but maybe in a more conventional filmmaker's hands, where they would have taken a look and said, this script needs punching up, maybe that would have, you know, happened. But in the case of Argento, I mean, you know, it's clear he doesn't care about the script. He doesn't care about whether things are make a ton of sense in his movie, so...
Maybe not that he doesn't care, but he cares far less about making a distinctly visual type of filmmaking.
Yeah. And it's... And I feel bad for saying it, because, again, you know, it's like he is... you can't take his visual style away from him, because in all the films of his I've watched so far, there are shots and sequences that are beautiful. I think, you know, as much as I kind of made fun of the theatrics of the opening shot with the psychic in there, I like the sort of ornate style he brings. I like the fact that there's this theatricality and artificiality that almost exists in that sequence. It's just that that sequence sort of exists in a, you know, in this one isolated location that is compartmentalized away from the rest of the film, which it seems to consist of these sequences, yeah, which sort of stand on their own. And
they're very consciously offset from the rest of the film. And again, yeah, that gives further credence to the idea that this is a film built on sequences first and foremost.
Yeah. And I mean, it's very telling. And again, maybe this is different in the Italian version, but you know, the police, you know, which you would figure would play a much bigger role in the film, barely factor into the American edit of the movie, where, like, they, you know, we have the curmudgeonly detective who looks like he's constantly, like, his pants are too tight or something. Just something's making him really unhappy.
Yeah. And also eating sandwiches very loudly.
Yeah,
and, like, the police sequences, they really just come off as, like, slapstick more than anything. And, yeah, like, there's just... I think it's because we have these two different stylistic registers that also leads to a pretty big shift in tone from scene to scene. And so the result is a film where there's plenty of stuff going on, but you can never really congeal how you actually feel about it as a whole. And so, because yeah, I think my overall evaluation of the film, because we're getting to that point, is that, yeah, there is a lot to like, and there is a lot of interesting things happening in the film, but I can't confidently say that the film itself overall is interesting or something that I would recommend. I would say, again, if you are interested in film style, this is a film well worth going out of your way to find. But at the same time, like, it feels like the parts end up being so much more than the whole of it.
Yeah, no, it really is. Like, I mean, again, if you're also, you know, a fan of the genre and you want to see sort of, you know, noteworthy landmarks in it. Like, I can't say that, you know, I can't take away from the film that it is, we've already acknowledged here, that it's had influence, that it is significant in that regard. And it's probably worth seeing for those purposes. I just, yeah, I can't recommend it as this is something you need to go see just for, you know, either sheer entertainment sake or because this is an artistic experience that's really going to rock your world. It isn't. It's just, unless, and again, maybe if you're like, you know, under the, I mean, the age of 20, and this is, you know, sort of, you know, you're an early dive into the art house or world cinema for you, you know, maybe you'll get more out of it as a sort of stepping stone. But I'd be more likely just to recommend Mario Bava's work to you because it's just better.
So I guess all that to say, a more accurate title for this film would be Superficial Red.
Yeah,
you can send all your postcards to me now. So, David, I guess to wrap up, we'll turn to our time-tested, patent-pending bumper segment, Hits and Pits. So these are the smaller details that we may have noticed that made us squeal or drove us crazy. So I'll ask you, is there any hits that you'd like to bring up that we haven't touched on?
Yeah, we talk about David Hemmings and the thing about, we never really talked about him as a performer, and he's fine. Like, I mean, he does what he's asked to do in this movie, and he does it well. It just feels like kind of a waste, particularly when, you know, the plot, elements of the plot echo Antonioni's blow up so much. You would think that they would do something with that intertext of having him in both instances, and they don't really do anything. But yeah, that doesn't detract from the fact that Hemmings is a capable leading man and charming enough that, yeah, even though there are scummier details about him, you know, he is charming still. I can at least give him that, so.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's also hard to evaluate because Blow Up, his most famous role, I mean, he's playing a character that is detached and disinterested from everything. We see a bit more spark, or at least a bit more of an emotional range here. And, you know, he certainly comes off as fine. He's not wooden. And, you know, there are little moments, like some of the dialogue with Gianna, and even some of the dialogue with Carlo, where, you know, it sort of humanizes him in a way that the script itself never gets around to doing. It's a shame because there is that intertext, but the only intertext that's developed is from the viewer themselves.
Yeah.
So let's see. Hits. There's that one shot after he discovers the question mark boarded up room.
Yeah.
And then he discovers the painting on the wall of like a young boy holding a knife and then a dead body. And then he leaves, and the camera lingers on that shot, and as he exits, another piece of plaster falls off and reveals a third person in the room. That is a really interesting moment to me, not only because that complicates what we think is going to happen at the ending, but this, like, our entire investigation of the crime has been restricted to Marcus's point of view, and this is, like, the first real moment of rupture. So then all of a sudden we get the dramatic irony where we know something that the protagonist now doesn't, which is a break from the classic detective mode, and it's achieved really economically in just that one little shot. And I think that was a particularly deft piece of filmmaking right there.
It is, although it still raises more questions about this boarded up room. Like, did she just let him go nuts drawing on the walls? And then decide to plaster it over afterwards? And did she do all that by herself?
Does she really strike you as a responsible parent in the first place, Dave?
She strikes me as somebody who at least thinks through, well, okay, fair point. Not a responsible parent, but, you know, again, you're creating more work for yourself here, folks. Like, I mean, especially if you did it yourself, you already got to plaster up the room. And if you're going to plaster up the room in the first place and cover up, you know, not bother to move the dead body that's sitting in it, why did you cover up the wall?
Maybe she was an early investor in Airwick or something like that. It's or maybe she's just right by the canal and then nobody seems to notice the smell of decomposition behind a wall. I don't know. But I mean
I know.
Okay. What other hits do you have, if any?
Not so much a shot, but some of the lighting early on, there are sequences, particularly in the first scene where we're introduced to Marcus as he sees Carlo on the street. Some of the photography of that street setting, particularly the sort of neon sign of the cafe slash bar that's there, is just gorgeous. Like, there's something very painterly like this. And I mean, yeah, that's one of those cases where the logic of there being practically nobody else on this city street at all probably doesn't make a lot of sense, but my God, do I love the visual of it. So for those, you know, few minutes of time where it's just Marcus and Carlo on the street with this cafe in the background, it is gorgeous to look at. And then, it, you know, everything gets spoiled by Marcus making a really inappropriate comment about rape. Or not Marcus, Carlos.
Yeah, that definitely stands out as contentious.
Yeah, but if you, for, you know, a whole 2 minutes, you know, that movie, you know, I was right down with the visuals there. What about you, Andrew? What else is might you want to give a hint to?
I would like to give special mention to Daria Nicolodi, because she plays, as I say, she seems like she's acting in a different movie, but I think a lot of the fun to be had in this film comes from her character and her performance, where she's bubbly and effervescent, and, like, especially Marcus, who, the moment he's involved, is terrified. He sees everything as a hassle. He wants to make sure no one kills him. Like, Gianna, she is just excited. She's thrilled to have a story to work on. There's something sort of matter-of-fact and disinterested of, oh, it'll be fine. And I think they play off of each other really well. I think it's especially interesting given how the one other female character in the film is portrayed. Her character, you know, that's not to say she isn't problematic, but I think it's a really good performance, and she definitely conveys, like, a sense of vitality that the rest of the film is kind of lacking. So kudos to her there. As far as pits, is there anything we haven't brought up that you'd like to point out, Dave?
Ah, good question, because we've hit on most of the major problems that this has. Not so much a pit, so much as a question mark, should we be concerned, is one of the myths of Dario Argento is that in all that comes back to all the murder sequences in his films are, particularly for those POV shots, is that I think, you know, if I'm not mistaken, it's always his hands representing the killer in each of the films. So yeah, when we see crimes being committed, it's Argento himself, which again is such a weird detail that again isn't relevant in terms of within the confines of the film itself as far as its narrative is concerned, but as sort of this extra textual detail that you're bringing, that the audience who knows this brings to it, it adds a level of discomfort and kind of begs further questions about the sort of underlying misogyny and sexism of the film. Yeah. Because, again, it's particularly when you consider, you know, when you start finding personal details about Argento and, again, his sort of, you know, contentious relationship with Daria Nicolodi and, you know, Asia Argento has had some, I'd say, peculiar comments about her father and how, at a certain point, he ceased being her father and was just the director. That raises all sorts of questions in the back of my mind. And I know, like, there are people like Mick Garris who talk about Argento like he's this, you know, sort of, you know, warm human being.
Mick Garris directed Thinner. What does he know about anything?
Okay, Mick Garris actually is somebody, okay, I don't think he did Thinner number one. But number two, he did Skin, or The Stand miniseries, yep, and The Shining miniseries.
Which is there with Thinner. He also did Bag of Bones with Pierce Brosnan, which somehow finds a way to creep under that bar.
Okay, point of the matter is that Mick Garris actually has a long history as an interviewer and has basically closely associated with most of the major horror directors. He is the person who sort of brought together the Masters of Horror dinners, which sort of brought them all together as a committee. So I'm willing to bet that he has had a lot of, you know, interactions with Dario Argento. That said, I still find something kind of unsettling about him personally, and that doesn't necessarily impact the film. But I think increasingly in a culture which, you know, is raising all sorts of questions about the predatory behavior of individuals, I have some, you know, question marks surrounding Argento himself.
Well, I just jump in and say, though, that it's, you know, you don't want to read too much of, like, director's biography in the films that they make. But I would say in the case of especially Deep Red, where we are pretty much invited to be armchair psychiatrists in order to make sense of the film and everyone's motivations, I think, you know, it becomes really tempting not to just extend that to things that seem like, you know, rather one-to-one superficial psychiatric readings of Argento's own behaviors in relation to the film. And yeah, when we have all this lingering and, you know, like voyeuristic sexualized violence, and we realize, oh, well, it's Argento's own hands. I mean, it's like everybody bandying out. Do you know that it's Quentin Tarantino who's actually strangling? Was it Diane Kruger in Inglourious Basterds? It's like, well,
yeah,
it doesn't make the film any better. It just makes it a lot creepier. Yeah, it's tough because some of the things that happen in Deep Red recur among other Argento films. And again, like when you're looking at a film that's now 42 years old, you can dismiss some of it as being culturally located, but culturally located toxicity is still toxicity.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So, I guess that's a roundabout pit there, but what about you, Andrew? Any pits we haven't really covered as of yet?
I think we basically run through the gamut, other than there's that one moment where, after the murder of the psychic, who her premonition said that the killer is in the sixth or seventh row, they're interviewing one of the witnesses, and they're like, now that I recall, someone did get up. Oh yeah, who was it? I think they were in the sixth or seventh row. I'm like, this is the perfect combination of, like, weirdly specific and completely insubstantial at the same time. And I'm like, oh wow, that's just convenience. I would give special mention just to the fact that the film's script has led David's shared notes for the film to include lines like this, edited for radio. And to simulate all capitals, where did the wind-up stabbing doll come from? Did she build it? Did she buy it? If she built it, how come she has so much trouble understanding Marcus as a pianist? How the did she get it up there? What was its purpose? And, oh, it was never a missing picture. It was a mirror. Oh, you, Argento.
Yeah, those are my notes.
So for everybody who thinks that David sees the silver lining in anything, subscribe to our Patreon and you can see all of our show notes and realize that that's a bald-faced lie. Just kidding. Yeah. We'll never have a Patreon, at least not this week. But yes, as this week draws to a close, Dave, though, I suppose I am going to die trying to cover up my mother's crimes, and that means you get to take the wheel for our next road trip.
Are you sure? Are you positive? Because last time you seemed a little upset about where we ended up.
Well, you know, forgiveness is important, and you know, we must truly be the better angels in our nature, whatever that quote is. So you got one more shot to wow me, Babsy. Where are we going?
Yo, we're going completely off the map here because we're going to be taking a look at a film I have no idea about, I haven't seen, but boy, did the trailer and the cast of this thing make it look interesting. So we're following somebody we didn't discuss, which is editor Franco Fratticilli, hopefully I'm pronouncing his name correctly, to the 1969 film Machine Gun McCain, starring John Cassavetes and Peter Falk. And if that doesn't get you excited, I don't know what will, because man, oh man, those are two very interesting actors to put together with a long, interesting history. So
yeah, Columbo versus Mr. Gina Rollins.
Yeah, so we will see how this turns out. Maybe we're just going to come back next week and just, you know, be groaning in excessive pain. But man, count me very curious for how this one's going to turn out.
Well, that certainly makes two of us. And in the meantime, if you'd like to yell at us about how we blatantly misunderstood the point of Deep Red, where can people find you, David?
Well, James can find me at 24Panels on Twitter, and I believe he can find you as at FilmStripper, Andrew.
Yep, that is correct.
Yep, is there any other things you'd like to plug this week?
Honestly, not too much. I do have plans to start working on, let's just say, a dedicated platform that will be a nice companion piece to the show. But I'm not going to say it out loud because then I'll jinx it and make sure it never happens. So as we continue to grow and develop and get a format nailed down, we plan on having more resources to offer to you. If and only if so, we got amusing GIFs and screen grabs to make you laugh in return for listening to us pontificate. For now, though, Twitter is probably the best place to get a hold of us.
Absolutely. So, with that said, Andrew, do you want to take us out?
Yes. Now, remember, everybody. What was the quote? Oh, yeah. Oh, man, it's been a week.
Adventure may scare you,
but monotony will kill you if Carlo's mother doesn't do it first.
Goodbye, folks.